Well, we should probably clear up last couple things about longing for beauty and a couple of those aspects. Before we go into that, though, let me just kind of set the goal for what I feel in the spirit we have to address and accomplish in our lesson tonight. Out of Acts chapter 17, we read how Paul lived an apologetic, a defense of the gospel message and of who Christ is. And he did that in Athens. And if we were to read that entire chunk of scripture from verse 16 in chapter 17, all the way through his appeal to the thinkers of his day, we would really get an impression of at least how Paul lived an apologetic. How did he give a defense just by his life? But there's one aspect in particular that I believe the Lord is highlighting, and that is, how did he connect with those people? How did Paul connect with those people in Athens, specifically those in the Areopagus, those at Mars Hill? How did he connect with them? Because at the core of what we are going to discuss tonight, we're going to take worldview concepts and things like that, like what we just asked of ourselves. What were your assumptions growing up, and have they changed? What were your core worldview kind of things? But have they changed? It's important for us to ask these questions of ourselves, but it's even more important to know, do you understand other people's perspective? Because Paul understood how to connect with other people. And I believe it's part of what made him so powerful and why we can read so many letters from Paul. Paul was gifted at connecting with people of differing perspectives and mindsets. And I'll change that W upside down and say me, has a challenge in connecting with people of a different color, breed, creed, style, vein, whatever. I like a lot of people, but sometimes it's hard for me to see things from their perspective, or another saying, cliche, is walk a mile in their shoes. But until we do, it's hard for us to speak to them where they're at and love them and build the bridges to get them to ask the right questions or think about the right questions that will lead them to the ultimate goal, the choice. Because every single one of us must choose before we pass from this life to eternity, where we'll spend eternity. And why we read out of that letter from Peter that we've got to be ready to give a reason for why we have the hope is so that we can be that apologetic, and so people in our lives can be brought to a point of decision making. And that starts most often with us connecting with people and seeing things from their perspective, being in the world, but not of it. And that's hard for us Christians. The more we spend time in God, the natural propensity for us, the inner leaning, is for us to be different and to accept the difference as being systemic, or it's all encompassing. And so there becomes an us and them. So how that ties into the first question I asked about your assumptions growing up and have they changed? I grew up in a Christian environment, a Christian home, that was my worldview. So everything I looked at, specifically how I judge right and wrong, was filtered through a Christian perspective. Now, here's where my assumptions from youth to now have changed dramatically. I grew up discerning the world in terms of good and bad, because that's what I was taught. And rightly so, as a kid, you gotta be taught the simplest things. This is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad. But see, that's external motivators for an internal heart. And at some point of maturity, you have to have an internalization of that so that you no longer have to just water it down to asking questions of, is it good or bad? Do I smoke? Do I not smoke? Do I tat? Do I not tattoo? Do I hang out with people? Do I not hang out with people? All of those things, that's so immature. Why do we even think like that? Ultimately, it's got to be coming from the heart. We live it or we don't live it. And so here's where I've changed. I no longer look at people in terms of good and bad. I'm looking at them more and more in terms of dead or alive. Because God didn't come and make me a bad person into a good person. If that was it, he really hasn't done much. I might be a little bit better bad. You know what I mean? I mean, to use a psychological excuse or whatever, there's always an advantageous comparison. I can always compare myself to someone worse and make myself feel better about me. That's just being, you know, a scapegoat or a scape lamb. And, you know, and it's like just finding someone worse to compare myself. At least I don't do that. At least I don't do this or whatever. I'm better. Oh, that's not what God did. See, God took me when I was dead in my sin, even though I didn't realize it or know it. I became so vividly aware of it. And my only hope was Jesus. And in those moments of transformation, I really became alive. I became alive to who God was and what that meant in my life. And from that moment on, things started to change. And I wasn't really even in control of the change. He really took over the whole bridge of this ship and started steering it in whole new directions and messing my life up sometimes and shaping everything. And ultimately, when it comes to worldviews and dealing with people, if we're still looking at people in terms of good and bad, we're missing what Paul knew. You're not dealing with good and bad people, you're dealing with dead people that need to be brought to life. And all of us were dead at once. And all of us must be brought to life, or eternity is in the balance. You spend eternity in hell. And so that's the heartbeat behind this message. I feel so pressed in my spirit. Lord, change the way we think, so that we might see from other people's perspectives, so that we might be your hands and feet and connect with them where they're at. You know, it's like, help us all be a little bit more like a Mother Teresa that preaches less and lives it more. You know what I mean? And so it's a powerful message for tonight. But before we get into that, let's cap off the last 2 points from last week. And everybody take a deep breath. And to bring us up to speed of where we were at last week in summary. So we were talking about the existence of God. And we were talking about how do we argue the existence of God and talk about the existence of God. You know, because apologetics is, in essence, we're taking people from an awareness of God to an awareness of truth and what truth really means. Let me say that again while we're still shifting papers. Remember the overall goal of what we're doing in conversations with people. When we're talking with our neighbors or we're talking with good folks and just nice folks, you're taking them wherever they're at their awareness of God, whatever that means to them. You're taking them from an awareness of God. You're taking them to an understanding of truth implications. How's your truth being lived out and what are the effects of that in your life? And then ultimately, if they accept the truth of God, they submit to God. If they reject the truth of God, they insert their own truth and they live with the consequences of that. But that's our goal, is to get them to the place of seeing truth in the way things really are and then submitting to God, God's truth, making that choice. So it starts a lot of times with just talking about, is there really a God? And that proving or talking, helping them remove their objections to, well, I just don't believe in God. Or maybe it's, I just don't believe in God of the Bible. I believe in God of the God of the fat man, or God of the kitty cat at the little diner that I go to, you know, or God of the, I don't know, whatever it is that they believe in. And so what we stopped at last week was we talked at another way to begin to argue the existence of God. We talked about things like the moral argument. We talked about different evidences for it and things like that. But here are the last two things that I'd like to point out. And this one is the quest for beauty. When I say the quest for beauty is a good way for us to talk about the existence of God, what I mean is... there is something in us. C.S. Lewis used it, if I'm going to remember it, I'll probably botch it to pieces, but C.S. Lewis made a quote. He said, if you can imagine a fish in its fish tank complaining of the wetness of its fish tank, what would that mean? Except that the fish must be created for another environment than the one it's in. And so, in reality, I can't imagine a fish complaining about the wetness of its fish tank. It probably is like, never even thought about it. You know, it's just wet and it likes it. That's because that's what it was created for. But human beings often have a quest for something more beautiful than even what's here. They just have this longing to worship something or to find worth in something. That's why there's so many people that flock to the Grand Canyon and gawk at it. Why? Why do they do this? Why do we do this? Because we long to find something that just inspires and is beautiful. And why aren't we satisfied with the wetness? Why aren't we just satisfied with the way the mundaneness of every day? Because we were made for something grander than just every day. And that is a great segue into, what is that? God. Something more perfect than anything that's perfect on this earth. You get into it, you experience it. Once you've seen the Grand Canyon, you've seen it four times, five times, it's lost its luster quick. I've stood on top of massive mountains in America. I've stood right there at Half Dome. I've looked over Yosemite. I've stood on the mountain peaks in New Mexico, in Colorado, at Pikes Peak. I've been in the flatlands and deserts. I've been over on at Niagara. I've been on both coasts. I've been out of the country on both sides. And I look at all of the things that people take pictures of and travel to. Been there, done that. And it's like, I need something else. Why is that? Because nothing that's beautiful in this world compares to the beauty of God. We're the only ones that do that. Human beings are the only ones that do that. And so it's a great way to discuss that God has left his image or imprint on us. Ecclesiastes says that God has put in eternity in our hearts. I think that's a powerful concept that comes out of Ecclesiastes. I want to say it's out of chapter 3, verse something in there. I've put eternity in the hearts of men, is what he's saying. And so there is this longing for eternity and looking for something more beautiful. So that's a wonderful way to open up the dialogue for, is there a God? Yes, there is, if you think there's something worthwhile seeing and taking a picture and you want to see something beautiful. So that's one. What else do I want to put on? Oh, I wrote down that verse, Ecclesiastes 3:11. Fingerprint of God. Here's the other aspect that we can actually point to. In our quest for beauty, it's important for us to realize that there is a cycle of disappointment that people experience. And that cycle of disappointment is a great opportunity for us to say, well, how come you're dissatisfied? Why did the perfect woman that you married become now the thing you're disappointed in? Oh, I'm so sorry. You know what I mean? Because sometimes all people think about is the next beautiful thing that they have in life. And suddenly when it's not like, it doesn't really do it anymore. Well, you go, why? The only reason it matters is because you're looking for something that doesn't disappoint. That cycle of disappointment leads us to ask questions all the time as human beings. Atheists do this. Agnostics do this. Buddhists do this. Pantheists do this. Homosexuals do this. Everyone does this. They have a cycle of disappointment. And what do they do with that? If you're a Buddhist, you just say, well, when we get to nirvana, it's really going to be the absence of desire. We just need to stop desiring. and you just go, oh, whatever, you know, and it's just crazy. And you look at all of that, and it's very, very sad, but it's a great point for us to highlight, because it gives us the chance to talk about God and our longing for God. Another aspect that we can start talking about, have you noticed in our current culture, there is so much infatuation with fantasy? If you think about it, didn't you just say you just watched a superhero movie with your son? Superhero stuff with son. See, I you know, I've ran the gamut of superhero stories, and then everything from, you know, Lord of the Rings is another kind of fantasy world, and, you know, and all of the different things that we could just like bathe ourselves in the visual world that we have of fantasy and story, and it's not just in our culture, but it's kind of been a part of human nature. All along, there's been a craving for fantasy, and that's why we have like Grimm's fairy tales and all these things. Why? Well, they teach story, parabolic kind of truth, but really, it's more than the truth. It's we just want escape, and we love it. We love to imagine. And in essence, those are signposts that point us to, why do you have to imagine a land or a place different than your own? Have you ever thought about that?
Can I say something else?
Yeah.
Have you noticed that all those movies always have one savior in all those fantasy movies?
You're right. Kind of interesting. You're right. There's a lot of commonality to it. And you know, it really does start to bridge even cultural differences, because even in other cultures, they have fantasy, fairy tale story, and there usually is that savior icon. It's interesting. Why? It's in us. Like Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, God put it in us. And so we look and long for that stuff. So I guess to cap all of that last week's teaching up, it's basically argue the existence of God, but use any of the methods that we talked about last week to do that. You have a lot of tools to just talk about the reality of God. God is real. He does exist. So now we're going to shift gears, and we're going to start talking tonight about how do we connect with people and how do we understand where people are at. It's one thing to say, I've thought about where I started and where I was at. What were my worldview and upbringing and blah, blah, blah. But even more importantly than that, do we know our cultures? Do we know the people around us, their perspectives, their worldviews, those things? So Christians have predetermined assumptions about things. Like I said, I kind of judge things good and bad. When I think of biblical examples of this, how many of you remember the story of Daniel? And how Daniel was brought into captivity, and yet, even though he was a young man, he determined in his heart, he's purposed in his heart not to defile himself, even with the food from the king's table. He had this, as a Christian, he had a predetermined course of action, so that even before they would offer food or offer whatever they needed to do to help him become more Babylonian, he just said, no, I'm going to do whatever I can to reject that. That was because of his worldview. Now, not just that, but think of Joseph. You remember Joseph? Joseph had some pretty quirky things about him, you know. I mean, I don't think it goes over good in your family if you, like, tell everybody they're going to grow up and worship you. It doesn't go well, you know. I could just think my daughters, if the youngest one said, hey, I had a dream last night. Yeah, Brianne says. When you get older, you're going to bow down and worship me. I can just tell you how that conversation would probably go over. It wouldn't be really well. But see, there was an idea about God and covenant God that Joseph had, that God was real to him and related to him in very real terms, so that even when he was sold into slavery and was ruling in Potiphar's house, he had a worldview and a concept that predetermined how he should decide to respond to Potiphar's wife, didn't he? Do you remember that story? So when Potiphar's wife came on hard to him, he knew how he should respond. I am not going to disappoint God or you. He had even a good worldview about her self-worth. She didn't have a good worldview of her own self-worth. Yet he had enough of a God worldview. He said, I can't treat you like an object. That would be disrespectful to the way God made you. So he predetermined how he was going to choose. Now, see, as Christians, that's part of our internalizing those principles of Scripture and who God is and all of that. As we grow in Christ, we internalize more and more so that in every situation, we have predetermined courses of action. We know how to live and act and all of that. Now, if people don't know Christians, like we didn't know Christ until Christ revealed himself to us, and then we learned. Now, think about the disparity between our perspective and others in this world. It's night and day. We think differently. We've come alive. If people aren't in relationship with Christ, they're still dead. They're darkened in their understanding. They don't know. So should we be mad at them for not knowing? Should we yell at them? You're an idiot for not knowing. You want to, don't you? Yeah, I mean... If anyone had a right to do that, I'm sure God could look down from on high and say, you're all idiots. But instead, he didn't. He took on flesh and dwelt among us, identified with us, set all of his rights aside, took on flesh to really be one of us. It's the mystery of the incarnation. And in essence, apologia, living that apologetic, is you take on Christianity and live it so they see the gospel. You live it. And so we have to be very, very comfortable with understanding perspective. So here's my first real point. Can you understand someone's perspective and not approve of it? Are you okay with that? Or do you feel like understanding and getting to know another perspective that might be drastically different than your personal worldview? Just understanding another person's perspective, is that unacceptable to you? Does it make you less of what you are? Or can you understand another's perspective and it doesn't mean you approve of it, it just means you understand it? Do you feel that? Someone give me your response, because there was a time in my life where if I were to really push myself to understand a contrary perspective, I felt like I was losing my own identity and picking up something yucky from them. And I would be icky because I understood them. I don't know why, but I did. So I had a very close friend. We were close friends for many, many years. And he struggled with homosexuality. And when he came out and he told me all of these different things, and he had already lived in that homosexual lifestyle for a long time prior to me knowing him, prior to him coming to Christ. He came to Christ, but he struggled with those lusts and those temptations. And then he just like spilled the beans one day and said, I just can't do it anymore. And he went right back into that homosexual lifestyle. And I didn't understand him. I felt dirty because I felt like just being near homosexuals made me dirty like a homosexual. And so I literally just wrote him off. Anathema, you're nothing to me. And then I realized, I just burned every bridge. I don't even know the guy. I thought I knew the guy, but now I don't know the guy. And so then it took me years to start to rebuild even the capacity to say, can I understand his perspective? How do I relate to him? And that, I felt I couldn't relate to him at all. And then I was like, oh, it's not that hard. I know what lust is. Okay. All right, I think I can relate to you. And then suddenly a dialogue was able to be started. Suddenly an openness. And I'm telling you, that was hard for me. Because I felt just trying to understand another person made me bad and less of a Christian. Caused me stress. How about you? Is it difficult for you to really understand and get close to someone who's just nasty and not worth whatever somebody else might say they're worth? You know, well, they just don't have their life together. They're losers. They're falling apart. Can't get to know them. They're just no good bums. I just want to go, can you get close enough to understand what that no good person looks like and what they think like and how they perceive the world? Can you get their worldview? If you can't see it from their eyes, it will be really hard for you to minister the gospel in a living, vital way. You have to be able to convert the truth of the gospel into their idiom. Make sense?
So did you let that homosexual come back?
Yeah. Oh, this is a good one. This goes to a tension we will have to be comfortable to live with. So you're cutting to, should we just go there right now, since you asked it?
Well, we can hold on to it, but that's my next question was, you rekindled
yes.
conversation, so.
In your note that I gave you, we'll just skip there and we'll answer this question now. In stepping stone number 4, the hurt of our culture, do we find it hard to keep sight of the fact that conversion is actually God's prerogative? This is good stuff. How do you respond when you are living the gospel and yet it doesn't automatically lead to conversion of someone? So your question was, how did it go? You start loving this guy, you open up your heart and try and see things from his perspective and try and minister to him. What has that done? It hasn't done very much to change him, but who's changed? Me. He's had more opportunities with my influence to have that gospel message changed, but still the prerogative is in God's hands for people to change. God is the only one that can take a camel through an eye of a needle. So it's really difficult for us Christians not to take that responsibility away from God. We like to take it away from God because maybe in part it justifies being a mean Christian. You know, it's like telling the stubborn person in your life, you have to hear this because your soul is on the line. And if you're not listening to me, then you're going to die and go to hell. And so here, you're going to hear this verse. And you're coming to church whether you like it or not. You know, and you just become, I'm so exaggerating the point to make it, drive it home. See, if we live like that, then in essence what we're doing is we're not living the gospel. We're actually just becoming Pharisaical and mean. And we're no longer salty. We've lost our saltiness. So it's very important for us not to take that responsibility of changing hearts from God. All we are responsible for is living faithfully and obedient. That's living that gospel message. And it's hard enough just to do that, right? Let alone take on the responsibility of changing the world or your kid. You know what I mean? Something like that, because right now I have kids, and so, yeah. I guess I will always have kids unless God takes them away, and even then I still have them, so, yeah. I guess I just secretly thought at some point I'll give them away.
Then just continuing just to love them and be kind.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you just, yeah.
Yeah, I had 2 experiences. One was when I was working at a nightclub. These 2 guys that are really nice asked me to take them home. I was driving and I looked in the rearview mirror to see if I could pass. Mm-hmm. They were necking. And I turned around.
Not something you see every day in yeah. in I Mary's car.
I said, you guys, I'm going to stop the car and throw up on you. But you have to realize I was not Christian then. I was more okay, the second one is Joseph. I was telling you about a smart cookie.
Yeah.
And Joseph grew up with my daughter, and in the sandbox, they studied music together. They went off, and he's a college mathematician, and she was a, I won't say. I'm at the church with okay. now, but I heard a little. The thing is, my daughter lectures. She's got it all figured out. And so my way of being Christian is I love mm-hmm. him now, just like he did when he was a kid. I know the troubles he went through, but I didn't really understand this.
Yeah.
So that's where my yeah. two experiences, from being a Christian now from before, telling somebody off what I was going to do, you know.
You know, in essence, what we're dancing around as we talk about this is when we're interacting with people, especially unbelievers, it's the one area as Christians I feel that we fail to do what we would do in every other logical situation. In every other logical situation, it seems that we only act when we have some level of acceptable understanding. Like, for instance, I just was doing some minor electrical at my house. There are certain things I don't do. Like, I don't really do major electrical from, like, the curb or climb up poles and reroute wires and stuff. But, you know, I'll run wires all through my house. But when it comes to connecting right in that big box, I will let someone who's really qualified do it. Why? I have a level of understanding, and I know where it is. So I'll only act up to my level of understanding. See, with Christians, we often prejudge, pre-assume we know and understand things, and we just act or react to people before we have any real, even introductory level of understanding. And part of the reason why we don't want to understand people is because you're so cute, is because, well, we don't want any of their yucky stuff to get on us because we're right and they're wrong and they should know that. And that's a very bad thing. So for us, we've got to be able to break that pattern down if it exists in our life. So you've got to be willing to, before you respond to people, have a degree of understanding, because then you'll know when it's appropriate to act in a very defensive way or a loving, hard way, because grace and truth have to have a balance there. You can't just, you know, let the world be worldly if in every circumstance. You have to be righteous and act righteous, but at the same time, you have to have understanding, or you'll hurt people and you'll actually drive people away from God. So get that level of understanding before you act. And, all right, so let's jump right into stepping stone number two. We really didn't talk much about how might you explain to someone how the Christian world addresses the questions of purpose, meaning, and life. And I put in parentheses another way of asking the four basic questions of a worldview that everybody answers one way or another. Everyone answers this, whether they know it or not. It's how they filter life. Everyone has an idea of where we came from. Everyone has an idea of right and wrong. Everyone has an idea of purpose, and everyone has an idea of destiny, what it's going to be like. It's important for us to know what those people we're talking with, what do they feel that way? And so use questions to ask them about it. Bob, well, how do you explain we're here, you know? And you hear what Bob says. Well, Bob, well, where do you say we're going to end up? And Bob says, oh, we're going to end up, well, you know, I'm going to come back as a different person, one with all of my fingers. And and then you go, okay, so now I get a picture of this person's destiny, what he thinks destiny is. And so do that. That's just that prerequisite to try and gain understanding where a person is at and see things honestly through their worldview, through their eyes. And so have conversations. Sit down and have coffee with people, even though they're way different than you. It's awesome to do that. So stepping stone two, though, is the goal of the worldview, we kind of touched on this, is so that we could bring people to that place of decision. You know, we argue and we talk about these concepts of worldview so that we can help people process and remove their natural objections to another perspective. We all have it, but we've got to help people dialogue about it. And we've got to be honest about it, like what we talked last week. And so stepping stone three is one of the ways in which we evaluate the things that people talk about their worldview and about where they come from and why they're here and what's right and wrong and where are they going for. See, this is one that we need to just write down what are some basic laws of logic. So let's do that right now. We're going to truth test it. And there are four simple laws of logic that we've got to be able to just kind of know. We don't have to be a theologian, but you just have to understand we all deal with these laws, whether we know it or not, and you can't live life apart from these. It's like the laws of gravity. So just the way they are. So the first law is the law of identity. The law of identity, which basically means an object is identical to itself. If that sounds cyclical or confusing, yep. An object is identical to itself. That's like saying a red balloon, if it's a red balloon, is not a black balloon. That's called logic. It's like the statement says, well, that's just common sense. Well, it would be common if everyone had that. But see, the funny thing is people try and live. That, remember when we talk about awareness of God and then truth, and they submit to truth, or they replace truth with their own truth? This is where people's logic breaks down. They say one thing, and then they say another thing, and they're actually denying this first law. It's not really it. And you think, that doesn't make sense. They think it makes sense, so it just, you have to help them. Well, you just said that's a red balloon, and you said it's a black balloon. It's a red balloon or it's a black balloon. It can't be both the thing. And they go, yeah, I can. Which leads you right to the second law of non-contradiction. So there is another law that sometimes partners with this, where a law of non-contradiction, which is basically saying you can't have two statements be exactly true in the exact same way. It just, you can't. It's not possible. It doesn't work. So maybe a red balloon could be a black balloon if it's not a red and a black balloon at the exact same time. If maybe you painted it black after it was a red balloon. You know what I mean? But it can't be both at the same time in the same sense. It just can't be. But that's that law of non-contradiction. And a way that people use this often in arguments or in conversations are they, if you say in conversation with them, well, I believe in the God of the Bible. And they say, why? And you say, well, because of that moral law. You know, it's like there's this sense of right and wrong. And they go, really? And I say, yeah. And where do you get your sense of right and wrong? And then they talk about that. And I says, well, see, that proves that there's a God who put that moral thought in you. And then they make some statement. Well, that's just not right. Yes, it is. I believe that that's right. Well, okay, I believe there is no absolute truth. Okay? Suddenly, you go, did you just make an absolute statement, like as if you had absolute knowledge? You can't say both of those and me believe either of them. It just doesn't happen. And you almost have to reflect that back to them and say, you can't say that. And then when they say, yes, I can, I just did, you say, but it's not logical. And then they'll go, And you just have to help them see it, that it just doesn't work. And so the first law of logic is identity. An object is identical to itself. The second one is non-contradiction. You can't have two contradictory statements be true in the same sense at the same time. And the next one, which is my favorite one, the law of the excluded middle. What in heaven's name is the law of the excluded middle? If you're aware of syllogism, this is what it means. I have ears. Elephants have ears. I'm an elephant. This is exactly the law of excluded middle. They find commonality and they take two things and say they're the same. Just because two things might be the same in one aspect, it doesn't mean they're the same. It's just not true. Or, I have ears. Elephants have ears. I'm an elephant. And now, how does this apply to when people are talking about their worldviews? I'll tell you exactly how it applies. This is all over. It's like epidemic levels. People in our community right here have lumped Christianity with every other religion. Every religion is the right way for that person because every faith is the same. Why? Because they're saying there's a similarity in one area, so they're the same. Oh, well, you guys are just like the Jehovah's Witnesses. Why? Well, you both read out of the same Bible. Yes. No. Well, this faith over here also does this too, so you guys are just like them. No, we are so not like them. Well, the pantheists believe in gods too, so they're just like that. No, oh my goodness. And see, this is where people really get hung up and they get stopped. So it's good to just point this out. You've got to be able to have something in your pocket to pull out in a conversation and use the ears thing because it'll make them laugh and they might drop a barrier and you can say, see, just because something is the same in one way, it doesn't mean they're the same. And so just because you might be an adherent to Islam and you believe in a monotheistic God and I believe in a monotheistic God, you call him Allah, I call him Jesus, they're not the same. And then they go, oh, because I'm not an elephant. You know, and then they'll go, I like talking to you, is what they'll say. Oh, I like talking to you. Yeah, I like talking to you too. Hopefully I'm pointing you to Jesus that someday you're going to submit to the truth of who Jesus Christ is. He'll open up your heart and you'll see it. So the last one is the law of rational inference. Common sense. Common sense, basically. The law of rational inference. When Petrea and I were in Albuquerque, we were up at a Sandia Peak hiking along a ridge. It was about 10,500 feet. And there was about a 5,000-foot cliff. And the people of New Mexico did not install a railing. That's how lame they were. And so as you're walking along this, that's a pretty big drop. I would look at that, and I didn't have to have any scientists tell me in 10 steps, number 11 would be unforgettable. And in fact, about step number 5, 6, I was going, because I knew I'm getting closer and closer to stupidity. And it really is sad, but even on the last time that we were hiking up there, there was a young dad and he had a toddler and he was sitting with his legs over the cliff holding his toddler. I tell you, we were livid. I wanted to take a child from somebody and accidentally push someone over, you know, at the same time. It was so upsetting. But see, that's the law of its inference. It's this sense of rational conclusions. I put A plus B plus C equals D. And that is very, very important. You've got to be able to put those dots together. And that's a law of logic. One of the best ways that I could think about this is in theater. Early on, I had a theater teacher tell me, you want to know the rule of comedy? Comedy is this rational inference broken. So they have a formula in comedy. It's 1-2 break, 1-2 break. You set something up, you then affirm it again a second time, and now you've got a pattern. It's like, huh, funny, okay, it's predictable. And then the third time, you break it. Something unexpected. And so it's 1-2 break. And then everybody goes, ha. And that's what it is. So one guy walks into a bar, the next guy walks into a bar, the third guy walks into the bar and, you know, and ducks or something like that. I can't even think of a good joke to actually tell this, but you know what I mean? and it's just funny because we break that rational inference and we think it's odd. It's funny. It makes us laugh. It's because it's built into just the way things really are. So those are the laws of logic. Why do we even need to talk about that? Well, because it helps us help point others to thinking about their perspectives and their worldviews. So now let's talk about the hurt of our culture and the four problems in stepping stone number five. So well, can I tell you why I think this is funny that we talk about rules of thinking and logic? We have to think. We have to love God with our minds. And we have to love God with our minds when we're talking with other people. It's important because everyone, we're going to talk about this in a couple seconds, but everyone has this built-in sense of we don't want the light and we don't want the truth. Until you're born again, there's this, it's oil and water. You just don't like it. It's like a story I heard describing this. It's like if a little kid eats a cookie from the kitchen and he wasn't supposed to, and dad or mom comes in and discovers that a cookie was eaten. And then they quickly call in little Johnny. Johnny, there were four cookies here earlier today and now one of them is gone. Did you eat the cookie? If that little boy responded with, "What is a cookie?" Most of us would go, "What? You either ate it or you didn't. Is a cookie?" You would just go, "Why are you doing this?" And it's the simplest way for us to understand how even at young ages we want to run a distraction. And in culture, even though we're older, we all want to run a distraction. So when we're talking with coworkers and we're talking with people who do not believe in Jesus yet, a lot of times the conversations equate to just that. You say, "Hey, do you know Jesus?" And they go, "What is truth?" And you go, and it's so funny because they secretly don't want to even acknowledge that they did something wrong or that they're wrong or in need of a savior. They don't even want to talk about it. The whole conversation is wrong. So what do? They just turn philosophical and weird. And whether they know it or not, that's often what they do. So I think it's important for us to help them talk through it and just be sympathetic to it because we all have been there. And there's still the residue of that in our lives. Think of your husband and wife situation. "Honey, did you do blah, blah?" "Well, you got to understand." And sometimes it's a fancy dance you do to try and get out of guilt. It's a fancy dance you do. And it really just boils down to, "Yeah, I ate the cookie. I'm wrong. Sorry." But it's never that simple, is it? Okay, so let's talk about why we have to run that interference often. And so to do that, let's talk about four of the problems that it's just very important that we don't need to be surprised by this. We have to be cool with this. Let me make sure I find out where I'm at. Yep, I don't want to go through that one. We're good. We're good. Okay, we'll... Okay, so here's the four things that we see, and it can be difficulties for us. So why is it? I'll ask you the question. You give me your first answer to it. Let's see what we come up with. So what are the four aspects of an unbeliever's perspective that we must recognize? And I want to hear from you, how come this is a dilemma? Why? So here's the first one. The human problem is not finite or small. It's a big one. It is all-encompassing. It's this: fallenness, sinfulness. So the first problem, Christianity says, what's wrong? Remember, it answers that question, what's wrong? And it also has to answer, well, what do you do to fix it? So in essence, the issue we're dealing with every person that's an unbeliever, is you're dealing with somebody that is sinful and fallen. So think about that for a second. What does that mean? They're sinful and fallen. That's just what they are. So we want to talk about that in a couple seconds. So you come to some applications. What does it mean to be sinful and fallen? What do sinful and fallen people do? All right, so the next thing is, you can expect a sinner to insist on his own view of things. See, unbelievers insist on their own way, their own view of things. Remember, once, if you're dealing with a Christian who submitted their life to Christ at the core of God being Lord, so Romans 10, 9 and 10, the heart of the gospel being accepted is you've confessed him as Lord. You've given ownership of your life to someone else. He tells you how to live. You've submitted that right to someone else. If you're not a Christian, you are still on the bridge of your ship telling the world how you want it to be. You're still the one that matters to you the most. Your perspective is the only perspective. So that's the next systemic problem. Your worldview is simply that, your view. Your truth is the most important. Here's the third problem. Sin involves an evasion of the truth. Boy, John tells us this plainly. That light comes into the world and we don't like the light because of the darkness that's in our hearts and we're just fallen. So at the core of every unbiblical worldview, non-Christian worldview, you're dealing with a person that doesn't really want the truth. They don't even want it. Even if you offered it to them and made it tasty and put like whipped cream on top, they'd go, still don't like it. So there's this innate sense of, it's yucky. So, and then the fourth and final thing. Sin has darkened their understanding, which means there's intellectual and moral confusion. So understanding is both lived out and their statements of fact and truth that you actually adhere to. So it's an intellectual thing that's darkened and fallen. They just don't understand it that way, but then they also don't live it. I think it was Brianne that we were talking the other day, and she goes, or Chloe. Chloe said, Dad, I know what wisdom is. And I said, really? I just love her because she really gives me these zingers every now and then. She goes, I know what wisdom is. And I said, well, lay it on me, baby. And she said, she says, wisdom is knowing. Oh, what did she say? It was like, she said, I know, I forgot wisdom. Bob is laughing. Bob is like, you don't even have wisdom. I was like, I know. She's like, she said, it's like knowing math and then doing it. And I was like, it was something like that. And I was like, all right. And it, in essence, you might have the information. That's not wisdom. But if you can apply it and do it, that's wisdom. And so sin has darkened us both on the intellectual level. They just don't know what they need to know. But then on the living it, they don't live it either. So there's moral confusion. So there's discrepancies all over the place. So even if they had a statement that was true, they don't even live it. And they don't even see the discrepancy. So it's all messed up. So those are the four things. Sin is systemic. There's fallenness and sinfulness. So that's the way people are. They insist on their own perspective. They avoid the truth. And the last one is there's darkened understanding. There's intellectual confusion and moral confusion. So now I want you to tell me, is this put any of the people we talk about and the people that we try and see things from their perspective, do you see the dilemma? A dilemma is a hard choice that they have. It's like two difficult choices. So think of it. Put yourself in the shoes of someone that's an unbeliever that you could talk with. Is it a hard choice for them? Why is it hard? Looking at those four things, what's difficult about them hearing what you say?
They don't want to change.
What else? Why is it difficult for them? They like their sin.
Yeah, they like
they like their way of life.
Yeah, they like to do things that make them feel good, you know, and sinful things. Being greedy and sexual, whatever. They just want to do it.
Yeah. So does it make them bad? No.
No.
Does it make them dead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all sinners.
So, because if that makes them bad, then we're looking at it still at a little bit of a tweak. Yes, you could say it's bad, but you're missing the perspective. The perspective is they don't understand. They're dead. They're darkened. You've got to be able to see it from them. And if you can do that that subtle shift, you'll be free to love the unlovely. You'll be free to do good to those that don't do good in return. Because, you know, have you ever seen, I just met this guy who just told me, he goes, I'm going to do a no-kill animal place. And I said, that's cool. What does that mean? He goes, well, you want to rescue dogs and stuff and everything. And I was like, that's great. When I think about somebody who does that, I'm like, do you imagine the patience and the tolerance you must have for a little raggedy, nasty dog that you just picked up? You don't even know what kind of rabid diseases it's got. And I bet you that weird person who loves that unlovely dog isn't freaked out when it bites him. He probably, the first dog that's stinky and ratted bites him, and his response might be, ow, but it's definitely not going to be, ew. His response will be like, ow, oh, it doesn't know any better. It's an abandoned, ratty dog. Let's give it a bath. See, that's the issues that have to be dealt with us, because when your sinful, darkened, dead neighbor treats you like a sinful, darkened, dead neighbor, or do you go, I'm going to love the unlovely. I'm going to do good to those that persecute me. I'm going to bless those that curse me. I'm going to embrace them even though they smell bad. I'm going to, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, it's amazing, but it changes the way you live and love people, and it gives you that opportunity.
You know, Pastor Brad, when you were saying, like changing your mindset, like if you know you're walking into a situation where people aren't saved.
Yes.
Into that, like, okay, how are you going to be in this situation? And it makes me, Jeff and I talk about this a lot, about Jesus walking through the streets with sinners.
Yep.
And I mean, I'm sure he wasn't condemning them, you know, he was just loving them where they were at.
Yeah.
And,
you know, when you think about, you were going to say something.
Yeah. You don't want to judge it.
Yep.
There's that part.
It's very, very true. So, and both of those elements are things that we can't escape, because right and wrong is definitely a thing we must confront and deal with. But what comes first? It's like the chicken and the egg. So when John 3 talks about Jesus coming to the earth, what came first? Well, I'll tell you, in biblical terms, what came first was the revelation of the law. And that was insufficient to do salvation, wasn't it? It awakened junk. When Jesus came, he expressed this interest. I came not to condemn the world, but to set it free, right? So in the process of showing that I cared so much to send my only son, it proved to a world what love was. And so what came first, right and wrong, or care? Care came first. God loved. The funny thing is that's what gives us the power to change. So in another way, Ravi Zacharias talks about this. He says in apologetics, he says, before you give someone a bouquet of roses, the gospel message, and tell them to smell it and see how wonderful it smells, don't cut their nose off. And so it's no good for us to want to be right before we're loving. Or another way, people don't care until you show you care. So they don't care what you care about until you show them you care. So it's not that we do away with right and wrong. It just has to come after love. People must know you affirm them and love them before they care what you care about. And that's important. And that's often why gangs work. A lot of kids that are in gangs, because growing up in the city of St. Louis from my late teens on, there were gangs all over the place. And I went to a school in the inner city that was horribly gang filled. I saw one girl die from an overdose right in front of me, and I was in junior high. There was gunshots all over the place. There were drugs going all over the place. There were many times where, like one, I was tackled by a guy running from the cops, and he stuffed a whole bag of dope. This was back when dope was still illegal everywhere, and stuffed a bag of dope in my pants to get away so I would be left with the dope and stuff like that. And it was horrible, living around a gang. But you know what? It's rare for me to remember any person that was in that gang lifestyle that loved it. They could say with great veracity, yeah, I don't like this about it, I don't like that about it, I'm unhappy about this. And they could point out all these yucky things, but I'll tell you why they were in it. They were in it because of this common bond, this culture, this sense of affirmation and acceptance. As twisted as it was powerful because there was great identity and great affirmation. There was a sense of love and acceptance, even though it was sick and wrong and codependent, you know, and that kind of stuff. But I'll tell you, people care if you show that they that you care. Yeah. That's interesting. I haven't really thought about that. You're right.
So, like, that's exactly how it.
You know what? I can identify with that because growing up, often I did better in the classes that I knew that I liked the teacher or that the teacher liked me. Mm-hmm. It kind of the same thing. It's like I always did better.
Yep. You always needed to build a relationship before there was any.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think in Christianity, that's very similar. So, yeah. Well, we're done. There's more stuff. I'm done. So there's more that we could talk about, but it's a let's say this. A biblical example. I opened up with Acts 17, and you could read through verses 16 through 40 or 34 and hear how Paul said to those people in Athens. He said, guys, I see how you're religious. He said, I see how you're religious. You have idols and you're really looking for something to worship. In that little chunk, he was telling us what we've been discussing about. He knew how to see the world through their eyes. And then he said, now I can identify with what you're looking for and what you're wanting. And now let me tell you where I find that. So he really had a great way of identifying with people and being able to see and understand what they're seeing so that then he could point them, redirect them, and give them signposts to what really was important. But then I also think of in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 19 through 24, I put it in your notes. Paul also used this same concept within the church culture too. This was a way he did life. He said, guys, I become all things to all people so I might win some. He's talking about even in the Christian culture, he was very conscious about how he lived his life and put it in the context of, I've got to know the way my audience will see what I do. I've got to know what they'll perceive when I'm with them and when I am talking to them. So it's not people pleasing, it's understanding your audience. It's really knowing who you're talking to. Because the same answer isn't meant to be given in the same way in every context. So when I'm talking with my preacher friends, there are things I say that if you were to hear me say it, you'd be like, my gosh, that was really harsh. Or you just kind of cut straight to the point and said this or that. And I'd be like, yeah, I know, but you know, he knew what I was talking about and we just kind of say that stuff. Okay, but then when a young Christian or somebody else, you might listen to me address the same topic, and then you'll come to me and say, do you even tell people the Bible? Because all I heard was you just say, I love you, stuff. You know, and that kind of thing. It's like, what? I don't understand. You're harsh with this person over here. Almost felt like you gave him a spanking. And then this person over here, you're like, oh, you baby, I just hold you and I hug you. You know, and that kind of stuff. Wah, wah, wah. Well, it's two different audiences, two different perspectives. You have to change the message to fit the hearer. You've got to speak their language so that they can even grasp what you're saying. So it's very, very important. And Paul was a master at this. And so in conclusion, I just want us to be prayerful and hungry to live an apologetic better. Let's be better at understanding the world around us, the people around us, and how they view Christians, how they view their world, and answer all of those worldview questions. How do they think? How do they perceive things? And then you become what that person needs in your conversations. Talk to them the way they need to be talked to. Help them the way they can receive it. And it's powerful. Now, the challenge is to be in the world but not of it. Jesus was in the mix, but he wasn't the mix. He was in the mix, but he wasn't mixed. And so that's important. So let's pray. Heavenly Father, I want to thank you so much for your love and your word. And I just ask for you to help us. Help us to love people, to see people, to go to people, to be moved with compassion. In fact, Lord, I just want to ask for, I want to ask that you would help us not just know the truth and understand the truth, but help us to have that axiom, that way of living it. God, show us how to balance it in life and talking with people. And Lord, I just ask that you would anoint us to have great conversations with the lost, like you did with the woman at the well, how you just led her so wonderfully to the choice she needed to make to serve you, to love you. God, help us to be that salt and light in our workplace, at home, with our family, our friends, and our community, our neighbors. God, help us to love people right where they're at. You loved us just as we are. While we were powerless in our sin, you loved us. Help us to love others like that, Lord. In your name we pray this. Amen.